everybody, and welcome to the Native Plant Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John McGee, talking to you live from still the snow capital of the eastern United States, Middleburg, Virginia. And I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, my partner in crime, my brother in beer, Mr. Michael Berkeley, over there in Fairview, Tennessee. How you doing, Mike?
I'm good, John. How about yourself?
I can't complain. I can't complain. We've had a lot of melting this week. We still have a lot of snow on the ground, but Emma can get out and do her things.
Yeah, you can't.
Life is better.
John, you can't lose 3 feet of snow overnight. I mean, that's amazing. Ours is gone. We had, over the weekend, sun and 60 in the 60s. It's long gone, but, you know, it's just amazing. You know, people around Nashville talk about, you know, if you don't like the weather here, stick around, it'll change. And you know, that's just up and down, roller coaster. So yours is still, you still have snow.
We do, but we've had some pretty good temps, and I was worried about a roof for a time because we had so much snow on the roof, but it seems to be doing its due process and slowly melting off and going away, so we're slowly getting back to normal. I didn't even get out of the house until, like, Friday, I think it was, that we finally went out, and
wow.
It was just such a mess. I just didn't want to deal with
it. And, you know, to all our listeners out there, you guys that live further north, kudos to you. I mean, good for you. you have my sympathies or what, but we, down here, when we get 4 inches, we're shut down. We have all these hills around here in Middle Tennessee, and there's no, the show is over, and there's no snow removal. And, you know, but a lot of sledding. Oh, we love these hills when it snows. You know, we get to go out and have fun and break our necks. So it's been.
I love the sledding.
Yeah. So, well, what's going on with the podcast this evening?
Well, you know, Mike, tonight is the first night where P.T. Gazelle's music is actually welcoming us into the show. And I know you're good friends with P.T. You know, why don't you tell us a little bit about him and the song and introduce our listeners to Wildwood Flower.
Well, you know, fortunately, Terry and I live in just right outside of Nashville, so you can pretty much guess of all the stories and the songs written about the guitar players in Nashville. The musicians are here, the songwriters are here, and many of, you know, our good friends are musicians, and so PT, or Phil, we call him, unbelievable harmonica player, played with Johnny Paycheck, and he plays harmonica, jazz, and he plays bluegrass. He can play just about anything, and he goes to all over the world, and he also sells the Gazelle harmonica, and some of you harmonica players out there probably have heard about it, but anyway, he's a dear friend, and so I approached him about a song, you know, something that would fit with this Native Plant podcast, and it was, I mean, just right out of his mouth. He said, well, Wildwood Flower. He says, it's public domain, you know. I said, well, yeah, but, you know, I've heard that 1,000 times. He says, oh, let me see if I can do something different. So he came up with the harmonica bass Wildwood Flower, and he's got Bruce Brown, that was the guitarist with the Charlie Daniels Band, playing guitar and then dubbed over with Dobro, and he did a great job. They did a great job on this music. So we now officially have a Native Plant podcast song.
That's right. So just a couple of guys you picked up off the street, basically.
I guess so, you know, and I really appreciate what they did. You know, these guys are professionals. You know, they know how to put the music together, and they, you know, and so when you listen to the song, you know, you'll hear PT's he's got this one token hit that he does with the harmonica, and you can't miss it. And we're very fortunate, John, to have his song on our show. For sure. Really helps
Please
us out.
Please thank him. Yeah.
I will.
Yeah, and, you know, if you want to hear the song without Mike and I interrupting it, we uploaded it to our Facebook page. You can go there. We put some pictures in with it, so you can look at Wildflowers and hear that song. And it's just a beautiful rendition. And so we're just thrilled to death about PT, you know, helping us out on that. And You know, I also wanted to just once again say thank you, thank you, thank you to everybody who's listening to the show. We've been just amazed at how quickly things have gone viral, I guess they call it. But, you know, please go to our webpage, subscribe to our RSS feed. You can go to iTunes and subscribe to the podcast there. Pretty much any of your podcasting apps should be able to get you to the show. And you're listening to us, so obviously you found us. So you'll find us again. And, Mike, I have to give a reminder out every week that let's face it, we're not perfectly clean in our language. So,
I keep thinking every podcast we do, I'm just going to not say one particular word. And, God, that word comes out every time. You know, so
we're going to slip. We're going to slip.
But damn it, I just don't
damn
want
it. Damn it.
So this is an adults only podcast, I guess, you know. So we'll keep.
I'd say at least PG-13.
And then of course, as some of you already know, at the end we toast with a beer, and I hope that doesn't offend anybody either. But God, we have some good beer that we,
Yeah, at least we're toasted with, like, high-quality stuff. This isn't just alcoholic's beer or anything. this is the good stuff.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to say, Mike, a big thank you out to the Master Gardeners who've been sending the show around to their different chapters. And, you know, Master Gardeners are a very important way for the public to learn how to garden. And
a
source of volunteers.
Absolutely. And the native plant, the individual state native plant groups. I know Alabama has mentioned us, Kentucky Native Plant Society has mentioned us. And good for them. And you know, we're just doing this so we can spread the word. There is a big following out there, and it doesn't matter if you live up in the Pacific Northwest in California, down in, along the Gulf Coast or in the Mid-Atlantic where you are or in Middle Tennessee where I am, you know, there's natives, and the native plants. And we know that there is a switch. There's a migration of more gardeners switching over to them for so many different reasons. And we're going to talk about that pretty much every program we have, every episode, we're going to talk about the benefits of the natives. And some of them are pretty, you know, self-explanatory, you know, they're pretty, you know, they're durable, but we're going to talk about, you know, what about for wildlife, you know, and the particular plant is a workhorse in a particular spot for us and the natives. And then we're going to talk about later on, and there's going to be a couple of episodes, we're going to talk about the bad boys, you know, the invasive exotics coming in. So, well, I'm really excited about all the future podcasts we got scheduled.
Yeah, we have quite a lineup, and you know, if you want to see what we already have on the website scheduled, we've got 15 shows up there now, and so you can go on there and see some of the future guests we're going to have, but you know, some of the top experts in their field in the world. So really thrilled about that.
Right. So, well, and tonight, something pretty special since we're talking here at February 1st, we're recording this. right in the dead of the winter.
I can't believe it's February.
I know. Groundhog Day tomorrow. Is that right? Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
And he will not see his shadow here tomorrow. We're doomed. But you know, we're talking about winter interest plants tonight. And, you know, it's easy to talk about some of the winter interest plants if you just evergreen yourself to death. And you and I have seen some of those old landscapes of the exotics where there's the boxwoods and the yews and Japanese hollies and everything. But, John, I know you've got some favorites for your winter interest. You want to kind of talk about a little bit of those?
Well, the one thing I wanted to say is, you know, like you were talking about, traditionally we're kind of taught that boxwoods and we're taught that winter interest means it's got to be evergreen. And, Mike, I'm sure you've experienced this when you're dealing with a client who's not really into the native plant thing. And kind of the first question they have for you when you set the plan down in front of them is, well, what's this going to look like in wintertime? And, you know, I always try and remind everybody that, Well, you know, first off, you're not going to be outside in the wintertime. You're not going to be grilling steaks in the winter. You're going to have something that, you know, you enjoy from the inside. And you really want your garden to perform the 9 or 10 months out of the year when you can get all those flowers and everything. And then in wintertime, what Mike and I would like to push everybody to kind of start thinking about is, you know, your winter garden should be a lot of food, and it should be a lot of shelter. And, you know, we come out and we take down forests and we build subdivisions, and then we replace all those plants with non-native plant material, mostly evergreen, but not anything native to wherever we are. And we want to break that line of logic and talk tonight, you know, about some of these native plants. And this is, again, going to be mostly east of the Mississippi for tonight's show. We'll have future shows where we talk about winter plants for the Rockies. But tonight it's going to be mostly, you know, Mike and I talking about what we know. And Mike, how about we start out with some grasses? I know I love probably my number one ornamental grass, easy to go to, easy to grow, relatively inexpensive to buy, would be switchgrass, which is Pennicum virgatum.
Yeah.
And I know it can be a little aggressive at times, but, boy, you talk about just a fantastic 5 to 6 foot plant for the winter time. I don't know if you've experienced this, Mike, but, you know, I go out there after a snowfall, they're just smashed down to the ground with the snow, and then the snow melts off, and poof, they're back up.
And there's some excellent cultivars of the Panicums out
really
there
are.
As well. That's stronger, more color, and, you know, so, and it is, you know, the Panicum is probably the workhorse of all the native grasses out there. As far as varieties in a garden center, you're going to find the most Panicum virgatum variety cultivars.
What's the cultivar you use the most of that plant?
Northwind, hands down, and Rick Dark. You know Rick very well. You know, he really promoted the Northwind, and I think he talks about the Northwind. A tornado came through somewhere in the mid-Atlantic, and or some high winds, and blew down all these grasses, and there was this one Panicum that stood up straight and strong up to 6 feet, and it was the Panicum virgatum Northwind. So we use Northwind a lot. It's got a lot of bluish color to it. Great background plant. Of course, Shenandoah has been around for a long time. Yeah. That's what we call the Japanese bloodgrass on steroids, because you can get that red color, you know. So, but, you know,
we want to warn people to not plant the Japanese bloodgrass, because an exotic invasive. And
highly invasive.
If you're looking for an alternative, you know, this is one of them.
So. Shenandoah. Yeah.
Yeah.
What other grasses?
I like heavy metal as well.
Oh, yeah.
Just because of the name. And, you know, if any client has teenage kids, I usually will put heavy metal, Panicum heavy metal in their property, and then the kids are like, oh, that's cool, man.
Yeah. And I think that's what's cool. If you go in and look in a nursery catalog that specializes in native grasses, and look at all the varieties of the Panicum virgatum, all the red switchgrasses, and some are known for their form. And, you know, when you talk about the heavy metal, it's not just that blue color on the leaf, but it's that form. It has a little bit of a cascade form. Prairie Sky is another one that has some of that cascade, that blue color. But, you know, you've got a lot of variety out there on that one species in the Panicum virgatum, the red switchgrass, and big-time bird food. Goldfinch feeding off the seed heads in the fall. Yeah. Beautiful.
And, you know, if it's planted in a wetland, it's usually good nesting ground for, you know, migratory birds. And so great, great plant all around. How about you, Mike? What do you have a grass you like?
Oh, you're going to get a kick out of this, John. I'm going to go there. Andropogon virginica's broom sedge. Oh, gosh, we're going to get phone calls. I know. Broom sedge. But, you know, look at it. It's strong.
I love it.
It's, you know, I've got some photos of the snow and the broom sedge, and that kind of a orange, almost an orange copper color that the foliage has in the winter. And yes, it's a great cover plant. It has great seed heads to it, and to see it sway in the breeze in the winter, you know, just, and the sound, you know, we always look at it, you know, eye candy, you know, and what it can do for the habitat and wildlife. Shut your eyes and listen to the wind going through a patch of broom sedge. And beautiful music. So broom sedge, and I'm sure I'm going to get people calling me up and saying, oh, God, you can't be talking about broom sedge. But it's an outstanding grass. You got to, just
it's
like
an
the
outstanding grass, yeah.
It is outstanding grass. But you got to be careful with it, just like the panicum. And this is true. You know, we take a lot of these native plants and we put them under cultivation where they did not have to fight competition. They did not have to fight less than good soils, and you know, and we put them in a cultivated bed, and they tend to get a little, you know, aggressive. Well, that's part of it, you know, is that you don't feed them, you know, don't. If you want to see a ground cover red switchgrass, put fertilizer to it and watch it flops. You know, no water.
Yeah.
You know, dry as a bone, most of them. And don't feed them, you know, so they just perform. They're prairie species. We're talking prairie remnants here, so why not?
Yeah. Well, any other grasses? That's one of my favorites. Yeah, I love that plant. And, you know, that is a true colonizer. And I always refer to natives as colonizers rather than invasive or aggressive, because that's what they're meant to do. They're, you know, you have a fire or you have some natural disaster, and boom, you know, here comes the broom sedge back in to kind of get established and take over a field. And it's that first part of the successional forest. So, great plant. I guess, you know, for me, the other one that I like really well is prairie drop seed, which is Spirobolus heterolepis, which, there's a really popular Asian plant called rose fountain grass, Pennisetum alopecula.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know it, Mike.
Oh, yes.
To me, this is the native replacement for that. And I really love this plant. Do you grow this?
I do. I love it. It's one of my favorite green roof plants for grasses.
I thought of that.
Yeah. It's a great, I mean, gosh, drought tolerance, tough as nails. I love the texture. That fine hair-like texture of the prairie drop seed. And a lot of people don't realize it has fragrance. Smell when it's in bloom, and it's a short, you know, bloom. It's about 2.5-3 feet tall max. And when it's in bloom, smell it, and it has, some people have said, well, it's buttered popcorn, it's vanilla. It's talking about aromatherapy. It's great, great. Again, shut your eyes. This time, instead of listening, you smell, and you smell the grasses.
Well, I was going to say, Mike, you touched on a couple of things there that involve sensory garden. And, you know, you don't hear much about sensory gardens, but I actually have a friend who has a friend. I have a friend of a friend who's a landscape architect in New York City and does sensory gardens for blind and deaf people. And, you know, I wasn't even thinking about those attributes of these plants, but you just nailed it on two things of, you know, sense and sound, and that those are really wonderful things to capture on. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, and everything that we've mentioned is food. You mentioned it right up front, you know, food. It's food for the wildlife out there. And, you know, they're not going to come in and feeding off those boxwoods, and they're not going to come in and feeding off the, you know, and unfortunately, you know, they may feed on those invasive exotics and then spread those around when they become even more aggressive and invasive. But, you know, they've been living on, the birds have been, you know, living on these seed heads for thousands of years, you know, before we brought in everything else. So food, it's food and cover, which is huge for the grasses.
And the main reason, you know, I thought about, you know, concentrating on food is, of course, we got a 3-foot snowstorm, and it's really amazing how hungry the birds are around here. But, you know, as you can imagine, my garden's a lot like yours. It's just filled with bird seed. And so, you know, the birds are, all the birds from the neighborhood are here at my house at the moment.
What does that tell you?
Which is just fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, along with the grasses, I think another area that we don't really think of too much as winter interest is perennials. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the perennials that kind of bloom later in the season and carry their seed heads into the fall and provide food for the songbirds and things that overwinter in the garden. And Mike, to me, kind of the workhorse of that realm is the goldenrods.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we've got, what, 100-some species of goldenrods east of Mississippi.
And they're here because they can, because they grow in so many different habitats, you know, they're just, and talk about a butterfly magnet when they're in bloom, you know, and for pollinators, all our native bees, you know, go to them. So, absolutely. Let me tell you a quick story about the goldenrods. Of course, I'm a grower and I've got a propagator that has to collect seeds and, so we collect goldenrod seed, and different species all around the Mid-South area. And when we bring them back into the greenhouse, it's amazing when we open up the seed heads how many different insects are in those seed heads. So when the birds are feeding on these, they're not just like they're vegetarians and they're feeding on just those seeds. They're eating the insects, you know. So that when you say food, John, I mean it's meat also.
We mean food.
We mean food.
We mean food.
And ask.
And you know. Yeah, you know, the fall blooming asters kind of go hand in hand with goldenrod. They're both in the same family, and they're both very similar plants. But, you know, I love the fall blooming asters, the ericoides, I'm forgetting the common name of it.
Heath aster.
Heath aster. Mm-hmm. The heath aster is probably my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
It's so tightly knit and so nicely formed. And the other aster that I really like for the fall is Aster divaricata, which is now Eurybia divaricata.
Eurybia. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, we won't go there. If there's any, if there's any taxonomist out there, call me.
Yeah.
If you are responsible for changing what we have, you know, it's a going joke. There are no more North American asters because that genus has been butchered. And some of the names we're not going to pronounce. Eurybia is one of the better ones. You know, it used to be Aster divaricata, and now it's Eurybia divaricatus. So, that's an aster that grows in shade. What a great idea!
Full shade, dry, full shade, loves it. And you know, Mike, it blooms really late. You know, it's one of the last flowers to bloom. So you get a good flush of fall color. The foliage on the plant, as you know, has a real nice dark color to it.
Beautiful.
And I'm guessing they're going to start, you know, pulling some cultivars of that plant out here pretty soon. And then in the winter, the flowers turn to seed, and they get beautiful seed heads on them all winter long, which then, of course, provide food for the wildlife in your yard. So,
absolutely. Yeah. And you,
how about you, Mike?
There's a few herbaceous. I'm sure we'll talk one day about some rain gardens and using natives in rain gardens. And one of the things kind of hard to do in rain gardens is put those winter interest plants in there. But I like Juncus effusus, and it's the soft thrush. And I remember Gary Kaufman down in Nantahala National Forest, used to be the biologist over there. He would wear a ball cap that said Juncus effusus, what a rush. And you know, but you know, the Juncus effusus, the soft rush, is an evergreen grass. It's a rush. It's not really a grass. It's a rushes around. It's an evergreen that stands up strong in the dead of the winter. Some beautiful shots I've seen of the snow and the rain garden. Those things are standing straight up. So, and of course there are seed heads on that too. It'll profuse seed head on Juncus effusus. And then, speaking of the shade along with that aster was, Pachycendra procumbens, the Allegheny spurge. And I've seen some forms that had beautiful mottled pewter silver color mottled in it in the leaf.
Wow.
But right now in the dead of the winter, that thing is just it's absolutely spectacular. with all the different color of the pewter and the green. What a great ground cover for shade.
And, you know, Mike, I know it's comparing apples to oranges, but that plant is so much more beautiful than its Asian alternative, which is Paxcendra terminalis, or, you know, the regular Paxcendra that we've all
Japanese
grown accustomed to.
Sure.
Yeah. And our Paxcendra doesn't grow as fast. That's why I say it's comparing apples to oranges, because they don't behave at all alike. But ours is so much more beautiful. So much
absolutely
more beautiful.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just a little patience. And, you know, that's one of the things, John, we'll talk about. You and I know. We know these natives. And it's the, you know, the big P is patience. You know, a lot of these plants have been forgiving because they grew right on top. That whole idea of biodiversity with these species, you know, is that they grew right on top of something else. And they were not competitive with each other, you know, like some of these introductions have been. So we know we got to be a little patient when you plant Paxcendra pucumans, and I've done that in many jobs at residential, as I've planted out many plugs of the Allegheny spurge, and you give it some time, you get a few years, and you've got a beautiful ground cover.
It is. It is. Gorgeous plant. We've got it growing quite a few places around here, and I keep expanding it every year. So really love that plant. Yeah. Well, Mike, how about some shrubs? Would you like to talk to us about some of
those? Oh, yeah. Well, you know, this is it's cheating because there's so many in the native world, you know, winter inches. But,
really,
you know,
yeah.
And you know, you and I, we're going to – let's talk about it right up front and get it out of the way, because everybody, as soon as we talk to someone that knows the natives and we say winter inches and we talk about a shrub, they're going to mention the winterberry. So let's just say the word winterberry.
Yeah, it's a great plant.
You use it. I've seen some of your designs where you've used winterberry, and John, how can you beat that? It's beautiful.
You know,
you take a deciduous holly. It's like taking any holly and pulling the leaves off of it to expose those red berries, and they're beautiful.
Yeah.
And, of course, the birds will eventually get to them. I just had a mass of them wiped out by some cedar waxwings. And it was a smorgasbord for them. But until that, you know, they were beautiful red berry silhouettes. So yeah, let's get the winterberry. Ilex verticillatus, and there's many cultivars out there that I've come across, and some great ones. Some of you guys out there know exactly what I'm talking about. Some great varieties. But let's get a little bit outside the box. I'm gonna talk about the native roses. And Rosa Carolina, the Carolina rose. Mm-hmm. The rose hips, the size of a large pea, high in vitamin C. The migratory birds will come by and get them. What they don't get, they'll leave on for the winter birds. And not only are they great food and the high vitamin C, but the winter interest for that plant, you know, is really beautiful. And now the Rosa Carolina, the Carolina rose, is also a colonizer. So you mentioned it earlier, you know, is making that mass, that cover, that habitat for the animals. I have birds every time I walk by my clump of Carolina rose. I've got birds coming in and out of it constantly, so they love being in that and protected. You probably know this. I'm a big catskin man. I love catskins, and there's people out there that don't know what in the world I'm talking about. What is a catskin? Well, a catskin is a bloom. It hangs down. It's different species has, you know, different lengths of it, but it could be 2 to 3 inches. And there's two shrubs blooming around our place right now in bloom in February. And it's the American filbert, Corylus americana, and the Alnus serrulata, and that's the speckled alder. And they are blooming right now with these catskins, okay? And if you still need a description, look it up, what a catskin is. But they're blooming, and they're beautiful. Yeah. They're absolutely spectacular. And even though, you know, we did mention the winterberry, but for some of you that cannot provide the winterberry's moisture, especially down south where the heat may be an issue, Possum Hall holly, which is more tree, a little bit, you know, it's a small tree, but it very drought tolerant. The stems tend to be more a lighter color, the bark a little lighter color, so a little contrast with the red berries on that. And keep in mind that these deciduous winterberry and deciduous Possum Hall hollies are also dioecious. It means that you've got to have a male,
right,
a compatible male, for your female to have its berries. I had a client one time that wanted 50 of the red sprite winterberries, and we put them in all in a, I mean, what a show. But I had to explain to her that, well, for you to have the berries, you're going to have a male or two around. And she said, well, that means that it won't have red berries on those plants, right? Well, correct. They're strictly there to pollinate, the female winterberry. And so, at that time, the only solution that we can come up with is to actually rent the male winterberries for the spring. So we placed them for a couple of weeks, let the bees do their thing, going from the male flower to the female flower so that we can get the pollination going, and then we would bring them back and just charge our rental fee. So I think it was the first occurrence in our business of where we had stud service for some male winterberries. So, but yeah, you got to have for the deciduous hollies. And then, you know, gosh, I know this may be a little ubiquitous, but the color twig dogwoods, and I'll say color twig because there's red twig, yellow twig, and I know you've used so many of those. But one, the cardinal red twig dogwood in the dead of the winter, beautiful. And you're talking about food. When any of those shrub dogwoods produce berries, they're gone. The birds grab those. And of course, they do that more in the fall. And you know, we need to take care of our migratory birds. You know, they got to fly a long distance and they got to stop, refuel head on. And that's what a lot of these shrub dogwoods will do. I think you're going to mention something about witch hazel too. And I want to, you know, right now I just look at the landscapes, and if I see a bloom, I'm going to notice that. And there's the Hamamelis vernalis, the Ozark witch hazel, which we said we were going to talk about mostly east of the Mississippi River. There is a great shrub that I believe you use as well up there, and it's a large shrub, and it's that vernal witch hazel. Amethyst, it's in full bloom right now, and it's it's amethyst color. We're talking about all deciduous shrubs in this. And, John, I know
the only other one I wanted to mention was the winged sumac, you know, which Steve and I guess technically is a tree, but to me that's a pretty small tree and a shrub. But, you know, you were talking about thinking outside of the box and how many people tell you to plant sumacs in your yard, but you and I are both big sumac pushers, I'm sure, and I just, you know, there's not a better plant for fall color. They have outstanding branching, just like a Japanese maple does, and, you know, people plant Japanese maples simply for their winter effect, and, you know, you can see that branching effect in it. Well, you can do the same thing with winged sumac and feed a ton of birds while you're doing it, because they leave those seed heads on there that are just, you know, juicy morsels, and like you're saying, inside of there, there's just thousands of insects for the birds to eat. And I don't know if you know this, Mike, but you can always make lemonade.
The sumac. Yeah, it looks like pink lemonade because these are red berries, and you soak them in the water, and it turns the water pink. So, and add a little honey to that, a little sweetener, and you've got what they call the Indian lemonade. But, and, you know, the seed heads, you know, if you take them at the right time and you put them in your mouth, it's like no other sweet tart. It's just, you know, you got a bite there. But, you know, we're talking, we're talking a lot about these shrubs as you know, all these deciduous. But, you know, there is one out there that's probably one of the most mainstream native shrubs out there. And I know you use that a lot in your landscape. It's the inkberry. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, Mike, I don't know if this is a true story or not. I've heard this as legend, and it makes sense if you think about it. But, you know, inkberry got its name for being the source of ink for the early colonists in the New World. And so whenever I'm, you know, we talked about, you know, do you sell Buckeyes to Ohio State grads and, you know, all those things. And, you know, whenever I'm talking Inkberry to somebody, I always mention the fact that, you know, Jefferson would have dipped his quill in the ink of the Inkberry to pen the Constitution, to pen the Declaration of Independence.
And did you make that up?
No. I heard it from somebody. I can't prove it. But, you know, like I said, it makes sense.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. Because of the black bear.
And you tell that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You tell that to certain people, and they'll be like, I want all Inkberry. I just want all Inkberry.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's
so. But
that's
great evergreen plant. Got a lot of good cultivars. You can get, you know, Shamrock is a cultivar of Inkberry that stays very small, very tiny. So if you have a little townhouse garden or something like that, it's a perfect little plant.
Down here in the South, we call the inkberries the poor man's boxwood because it grows faster than the American boxwood, which, by the way, just because we call it an American boxwood doesn't mean that it's a North American native. But and of course, you're up there in the mid-Atlantic where boxwoods are king, you know, there's, you know, boxwoods. And down here, it's aristocrat of the South, that and crepe murders. But if you want a fast-growing boxwood-like evergreen, Inkberry works. And you can go to any box store during the growing season and find inkberries in their cultivars. We like Nigra a lot because it is a darker green and it stays green down to the bottom. Shamrock, I really like Shamrock because I like that upright, and I love the leaf color on it. But many varieties. There's a new one out that we've been playing around with called Red Tip. The new growth comes up with a little burgundy red, you know, so it gives you a little contrast against the green, but it works. I mean, you can't go wrong with the inkberry hollies. They're great. But, you know, and there's some other evergreens out there that, you know, we can talk about.
One other point I wanted to make that you just mentioned is you can go into any box store and, you know, a lot of these plants that we're talking to you about tonight are pretty easy to find. And not only are they easy to find, they're reasonably priced. And, you know, Mike and I both give talks all over the country and, you know, I've been to talks where, like, somebody will be talking before me, and they'll be sitting there going, well, these native plants are hard to get, and they're really expensive, and I'm just sitting there going, why are you telling people this? You know, I can go to any garden center, and I can buy an inkberry for less than I can buy a Burford holly.
Yeah.
I can go to any garden center in the country, and I can buy a dogwood for cheaper than a crepe murder.
Yeah.
So it's just not true that, you know, natives are hard to find and they're expensive. That's just not true. You just need to know what you're looking for.
And more so now, John, than it used to be. I mean, you know, the native plant movement has cultivated more growers, and that's what we need. We need more native plant growers, and not just producing a lot of the mainstream plants like the Virginia sweet spires and the dogwoods, the redbuds, the inkberry hollies, but producing some of those other somewhat obscure. Just because we don't see them in the box stores doesn't mean they're not good plants. We just need more of them out there, and they are becoming more readily available. And the more growers, this is what's been really fun to watch, is the more growers we have, the more selections we start to find. You get a grower in a huge nursery, and he's growing thousands of dogwoods. He walks along that row of dogwoods, and there's one that stands out to him that has maybe a shorter stature. It has different colored berries. Maybe the fall color is very unique. You know, that's a selection. You know, and whether it was a little skew in the DNA or whatever, something mutated it's different. You know, it looks different than the straight species. And so I think what's happening is a lot of the mainstream gardeners out there are tapping into some of those selections. You know, we at Grow Wild, you know, in the nursery, we grow 27 different Cercis canadensis varieties, you know, of the the eastern redbud. I mean, you know, why? God, every color, form, weeping, dwarf, colored leaves, you know, everything. And you can't beat a redbud in durability. So that's what's been happening with, you know, we do need more growers out there, sure, but there's a lot more now than it were just 10, 20 years ago. So, yeah, the availability's coming.
Yeah, no doubt. And especially when we've got great growers out there like Grow Wild Nurseries in Fairview, Tennessee.
Oh, I know those crazy hippies. Well, you know,
crazy hippie people.
Crazy hippie. Well, you know, John, speaking of one other tree, a small tree, and then I know we've got some other trees to talk about, but I want to mention, because you mentioned the habitat and food, I don't want to go without saying the hawthorns. As soon as I say hawthorns, somebody says, oh, really? You know, and there are some great criticas out there, and there's so many varieties of, you know, the mainstreams, you know, they're going to go with the Washington hawthorn. There's the Winter King hawthorn, which is an outstanding, great commercial tree. You know, you put that out in the middle of a parking lot in the middle of sun and hot, and no water, and it just loves it. And now, so why do birds like those so much? And we get in our nursery, we'll see bird nests in so many of our hawthorn trees. And yet I can't help to think that they feel protected because, yeah, sure, there's thorns on these. You know, most of the hawthorns, the native hawthorns, are going to have thorns. And they feel protected, and they've got their food right there, those red berries that come off that tree. So it's you know, a B&B for the birds, you can say. But look at the bark, the blooms. We saw honeybees a few years ago on our hawthorn blooms, and said, you know, and we're beekeepers too. And we said, yeah, sure, because they're getting pollen and nectar off of that. So, you know, feed the insects, feed the birds, protect the birds, and why not use the hawthorn?
Yeah, no doubt. Well, any other trees you wanted to cover, Mike? Or
well, I want to just, you know, there's a couple of evergreens, you know, the cedars. And, you know, you and I have been there, done that with the cedars. There are so many selections. And the University of Virginiana Birkeye is an outstanding. Do you use that in your designs, the Birkeye cedar?
All the time.
Yeah. And that blue color, it's a female, so you got your sapphire blue berries there, and, of course, the birds go after that. But something about that horizontal branching habit with that blue color that the Birkeye has. And, you know, you can't beat durability with a cedar. It's an eastern red cedar. You can plant that in the middle of a desert, and it's
walk away.
So, but when you see a Birkeye cedar with snow, a few inches of snow on it, it is absolutely spectacular. And then, you know, there's the shrub cedars. There's Royo that tops out at about 3 feet, and Gray Owl that gets up around 5 feet. And then it also has that blue color, and that's still Juniper virginiana. It's still the eastern red cedar, but in a shrub form. So if you're looking at xeriscaping and you only provide habitat, you know, there's nothing wrong with using a cultivar of that cedar in your front yard instead of those Chinese junipers. But then also, I can't help but talk a little bit about on the trees of just barks. And I know you've got some special ones there. I right off the bat is Caria ovata. That is the, shag bark hickory. And when you look up into a tall growing shag bark hickory, and you better believe it's an old tree when they get up tall because they're slow. But when you look up into that and look underneath that bark, you think, well, gosh, things can be living up there. Well, yeah, bats do. Then the red bat, you know, several different species you hibernate in the bark of the shag barks. And the bats, the red bats really love getting up underneath that shredded bark. But look at the texture of that tree. Beautiful and tough. Tough as hickory.
And Mike, why do you want bats in your yard?
Oh, well, why do you want bats in your yard, John? Well, for those of you that have mosquito problems, and we have them down here in the South. I don't know, up in Virginia.
We have a few mosquitoes.
So, you know, you got to think about what eats mosquitoes in the dead of the night, you know, flying around, and those bats. And they are workhorses for fighting that. So, you know, how many people put out bat houses and just kind of roll the dice, and I hope they will come. Well, go to the original house. for the bats. And that's the trees with the bark that shreds like that. You know, so a shagbark hickory, I just love that for the winter, not just because I think it's a beautiful bark, beautiful tree, but you're providing habitat for something we don't think much about. You know, sure, birds, and
right.
We think about the butterflies, and we think about all the four-legged animals. What about that other little mammal that's flying around up there? And let's provide a habitat for them, and that's for the bats.
Yeah, no doubt. And then the only other one I wanted to mention, too, for bark beauty, which to me, I always say, this is a tree that blooms in the wintertime, is the American sycamore, which is Platanus occidentalis. And that's just a – what did you call him, Mike? You
had white ghost. I mean, you know, it's just the white ghost
of the forest.
Yeah. Forest, you know. And you cannot miss a sycamore in a mixed deciduous forest, and especially in the winter. Look at that white silhouette glowing out in the woods. Oh, man.
And they're usually down in the bottom. You know, they're usually a bottomland kind of tree. They get magnificently huge, which is, I think, also really awesome. But, yeah, I really love them for their winter effect. People complain about, you know, losing their leaves in the summertime. I just sit there and go, well, you know, that's life.
That's life. That's life.
That's life.
Yeah.
But
what about the one big evergreen tree for you? I know you've got a special one. And it really means a lot to you, too, for many reasons.
Yeah, and it's unfortunately kind of a sad story. But I think you're talking about the Eastern Canadian hemlock, Suga canadensa. And, you know, I think it holds a special place in the hearts of a lot of us who go to Cullowhee every year, because we've just seen them die over the last 20 years. And it's heartbreaking. You know, you go out into the Appalachian Mountains, or, you know, down in North Carolina, up in Pennsylvania, where, you know, Hawk Mountain, where, you know, I got my start in things, and they're just dying from the fact that there was a bug introduced called woolly adelgid, and it feeds on Canadian hemlock, and it has no predator or anything stopping it. And so I don't know the facts or the figures, Mike, but as you know as well as I do, they've been devastated. Their population has been totally devastated by this bug.
And, you know, in the dead of the winter in the Smokies, and typically you would see these massive forest of green, and it's brown. It's brown now because of the woolly adelgid. So introduced.
Were truly one of the most magnificent trees on the hillside. You know, they used to grow kind of on that north slope of the mountain, and, you know, they just kind of wave in the wind. And, that to me was the eastern forest. Was seeing little patches of hemlock, you know, in certain places. And I don't know what the future holds for it. But again, you know, this is what Mike and I are trying to get across, is, you know, if you can stick with the native and avoid introducing something, you're probably saving yourself a lot of work and a lot of time.
Absolutely. Well, and John, I know you and I had talked about, we were going to mention oak, and I think one of the reasons that we want to talk about oaks before we move on is the big thing about the supporting of the life, the difference, all the species, and a lot of people don't know this, but if you read Doug Tallamy's book, Bringing Nature Home, he mentions it in there. He's an entomologist, from the University of Delaware, and he's a bug man, and he talks about, you know, if you want the number one host plant for the bugs, and if roughly around 86%, I believe is what he said, 86% of our native birds are carnivorous, you know, so you want to produce meat, you want to have bugs out there, you know. So what is the number one genus that produces the most, is the biggest host plant out there? And it's going to be the oaks, the quercus.
Quercus.
And how many, there are 24 species that occur just in the state of Tennessee, which is more than the whole continent of Europe. In North America, look at all the species of oaks. And, you know, you're talking about majestic. You're talking about the bark. You're talking about the leaf, the fall color. You know, just a staple in our eastern hardwood forest. Yet, when we have in suburbia, one of the last trees we'll think about growing. And I believe that's because we think, well, they're slow. You could take a Schumard oak, Quercus Schumardi. It can grow three to four feet a year, give you the most amazing fall color, and yes, provide food for what is it? 570
570 some species, I think. Yeah,
amazing.
It's an amazing number. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, Mike, as you know, I'm a mushroom guy. You know, I cultivate a lot of mushrooms, and the oaks are probably the champions for mushrooms. You know, you probably are familiar with chicken of the woods.
Mmm, right? tasty.
Chicken of the woods loves oaks.
That on the grill, yes.
Yeah.
Tasty.
Yeah. And then hen of the woods, which a lot of people call maitake, also grows at the base of oak trees, and you know, morels will grow around them and stuff. So they're just teeming with life, basically.
Mm. And the food from the acorns, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so Mike, I guess, you know, we should probably move on. We've got some questions from some of our listeners out there, and you want to take the first question there?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. And we really appreciate your questions, and it really gives John and I, you know, we really like to talk about some of these, that, you know, and okay, let me think about that. This is from Nancy Milam. And it says, my serviceberry tree, which was bought and set out some 4 years ago, has never bloomed. She asked, do I need another tree for blooms and fruit, or could my tree be in the wrong location? Well, of course, Nancy, without me seeing exactly where that is, I don't know about that. But usually, you know, when you've got a small tree like that is an understory tree, they typically can bloom in shade. Now, if you got too deep of a shade, they may not bloom. But here's the difference in a tree performing, which we want, the bloom, and a tree surviving, is that a lot of those trees have lived their life in the deep shade without bloom and been very happy. If they bloom, that is childbirth for that plant, and a lot of energy goes up into that bloom, which that bloom may produce berries later. Instead of the energy going up into blooms that you're not getting, the energy is going into rooting. So my take is that be patient with it. If you planted it as a small tree, it may take a little longer for it to get up to bloom size. Now, as far as the berries go, one of the things we know about service berries is that they like cross-pollination. What we do is that we will plant service berry orchards in typical suburbia and plant one tree of one species and two or more trees of a different variety, different cultivars. Mix Cole Select with Forest Prince, or there's several different varieties. If you mix those up, you'll get heavy production. And I will tell you, John, if you've never tasted a service berry, I will say I'll put it up against a blueberry on taste. It's beautiful.
Oh,
beautiful red berry. And Terry makes these pies with it and some jellies with the service berry. But I would say you probably give it a little time. And like I say, some of these plants, you know, if they're surviving, they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. If they're not performing to our standards, then, you know, not blooming, give it some time and maybe open up the canopy if it's in too dark a shade. What about this other question here, John?
We had an email from Molly, and it's not necessarily a question. It's just kind of a compliment on the show, but it was really nice compliment, and so I just thought I'd read it to our listeners. She says, loving your podcast, gentlemen. I was nearly moved to tears while listening to the podcast today about children's gardens. I left a preschool teaching position when they cut down all the trees so the traffic on the adjacent highway could see our beautiful building, and beautiful buildings in quotation marks there. We can no longer have circle time or really even play outside because of the noise and the fumes. I was sad. However, today's podcast helped me decide to accept a position at a nature-based summer camp program beginning in June. So, you know, Mike, we've actually, three shows in and we've already inspired somebody, you know.
And that's what we're supposed to do. Yeah, that's what we're supposed to do. Nice. That's great.
And if thank you to Jesse for that.
Yeah, so. Great. I mean, that was a moving that interview we had with Jesse Turner was moving for me. And one of the things that he mentioned is not just doing this for that generation, for those kids, because we know they're going to won't be the ones, the generations to make the difference. But he was looking at the space around the daycare centers as, you know, habitat, restoration habitat, you know, and why not? You know, and he did mention, you know, you got to be careful about what plants you put in, you know, there because you don't want any toxic plants or anything. But, you know, having a butterfly plant, having a plant that attracts a butterfly and letting that kid see that for that first time in that there at the daycare. But looking at that as a restoration project and you take the hundreds and hundreds of them throughout the United States. Yeah, it's habitat, you know, that he was looking at. I was really moved by that. So thank you, Molly, for sending.
With that, Mike, time to talk about our favorite things in the world, our dogs.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I was telling you last week that we had to create these tunnels for Emma so that, you know, she's just a Welsh Corgi, so she couldn't look out and above. And the thing you have to understand about Emma is she's the boss, and she is constantly working. You know, whether that's guarding the house or guarding my office or, you know, just barking at the wind, telling the wind that you're not supposed to be there. That's Emma. She's 24/7.
That's
and,
great.
So when she had these tunnels and she couldn't see out of them, she was just like distraught because she wasn't in charge. And so, you know how like snow will melt and then at night it freezes and gets like a crust on it, a little ice. Well, that's what happened here. And Emma figured out that she could get up on top of that and actually walk around it. And so she just sits up on these mounds of snow and perches. You know, she's very much a Napoleon effect kind of dog. So I love her to death.
And you know, you're talking about a dog that's what, about a foot tall at
if that
tops, if that. And in snow 3 feet tall. And I like what you were saying earlier that you mentioned during the snow that how many corgis high you were getting in your snow tip. You got about 2.5 corgis high, you know. That's great. Well, you know, of course, your other breed is a Australian Shepherd. And you sent a photo a while back, and, you know, you could have told me, if I had no idea what that dog was, I had a photo from you of your Australian Shepherd, your Aussie, from the back. And there's no, any of you guys out there that people that own an Aussie knows, there's a very distinctive rear end to an Australian Shepherd. And I mean, of course, Wesley, our Australian Shepherd, has got this. And I showed my wife, Terry, I showed that photo of your Aussie and said, God, that could have been Wesley. And it's, you know, this is a border collie without a tail. Okay, so they are born without the tails, but they have what one groomer called fanny panties, and it's this really this fur, this little nub of a tail that stays down most of the time. When they wag, their whole rear end wags. At least with Wesley, the whole rear end wags when they're happy because there's no tail.
His whole body does.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, Chewy. And so, you know, that's what I thought. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. That's an Aussie's rear end right there. There's very few rear ends that look like that. So, and I appreciate you sending those photos. Well, John, and then our other big part of the show is one of my favorites. All right. And you got your bottle ready? Yeah. Okay. On the count of three, we're going to open. Ready? 1, 2, 3. All right. And you know what? I don't know how good your beer is, but it sure did sound good.
It is really good.
Yeah. So John,
you know,
and
I'm
always
hoping.
Go ahead.
I'm still hoping that one of these days we'll get a beer sponsor for this thing. Somebody should step up and sponsor the show.
So any of you first-time listeners out there, you got to know, at the end of our show, we toast with a beer. And it's not just your regular old beer. And, in fact, he and I have made a challenge that every podcast we do, it has to be a different beer. Different style, different brewery, whatever. And with all the craft brewing going on out there, all the Marco breweries, oh, that's not going to be that hard to do. But and we always toast with a beer. We open it to our microphones and pour it in the glass to our microphones to kind of tease you people out there with our brews. John, what do you
drink?
You're more than welcome to join us. We'll give you, we're always at the end of our podcast, every episode, we're going to have a toast with a different beer. And, John, I got to ask, your sound is so good. What is your beer this evening?
Well, Mike, I have a delicious product of Dewclaw Brewing, which is fairly local here, Baltimore, about an hour and a half away. And it's called Sweet Baby Jesus.
No, that's not. Oh, really?
It's
Sweet Baby Jesus. I want it, and not even open it up. I want to just look at that label.
The first time I got it, I was just like, I got to try this. It screamed out to me. But this is a chocolate peanut butter porter, and. You know, that may sound absolutely insane to those of you who've only drank Budweiser or Coors Light, but this is truly, you know, you can really taste the peanut butter, you can really taste the chocolate in the beer, so it's an excellent brew. I'm really very happy with it.
Well, good. Yeah, that's great.
I'm
leaning towards a little bit of that dark as well, like your porter, but I've got a stout. This is one I found in a local... a beer store that I just couldn't resist, and it was a Kentucky Bourbon Barrel Stout, and it's a stout brewed with coffee from Haiti, and it's got the flavor of the coffee, but it's also aged in oak barrels with Haitian coffee. And this is the free trade coffee from Haiti, but you can pick up a little bit of that almost a chocolate stout flavor. It's an 8% alcohol by volume, and is put out by the Altex Lexington Brewing Company out of Lexington, Kentucky. So, you know, I think what's happening with brewing out there now is that they're getting away from all the old pilsners and ales that just brewed mainstream mass production, and they're getting creative with some of these beers, and I really enjoy it. And as a home brewer, you and I both know that, you know, there's so many recipes out there that we can play around with, but I really like this. And what you're supposed to do is pour this into a brandy sniffer so that you can get the aroma from the brandy sniffer as you start to drink that. But I wanted everybody to hear me pour it into a glass, so that's why. But it's an excellent stout, good for a winter evening.
Awesome. Well, that's it for this week. Mike, next week we're going to have Claudia Vasquez on the show.
Excited
from Isle Natives. In Washington, D.C., and his company basically has a really interesting business model to it because, and again, we'll let Claudio give you the very specifics of this, but I don't think they grow any plants themselves. I think they're mainly brokers for plant nurseries.
Sure.
Yeah.
And there's a place in the industry for that. We need, as I mentioned earlier, availability's there. We just need someone to know where to go to get them. And that's Clark. You know, good for him. Well, I'm excited about that. I'm really looking forward to that.
The only thing I worried about was, I invited him to stay with, to have a beer with us, and he said something about the king of beers. And,
you know what?
But, you know, beer's a beer, I guess.
It's beer is a beer, you know. So I'll drink one of my craft brew stouts. You get one of your crazy porters and let him get a Budweiser. And that's it's okay. Yeah, we toast.
We're not here to judge. We're not here to
judge. That's right. That's right. Well, John, I enjoyed this. This is a great episode tonight. Great segment, great program. Talking about winter interest plants, and excited about the future podcast. And you guys out there, keep those questions coming in. Any feedback, we certainly appreciate. Get ready for another beer opening for another podcast.
And if anybody wants to sponsor that part of the show, we're available.
And let us know what you think about this music. Yeah,
please. We'd love to hear that. We know you're going to love it, but we just want to hear that over and over. So.
Yeah, we want to hear it. All right, John. Well, you have a good evening, and we'll see you guys on the next one.
We'll see you on the flip side.